I will sit here and tell you right now, I cannot protect the campus if the K-12 kids are on there.
A legislative debate about guns on University of Alaska campuses. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a federal investigation into burned eagles at ADAC dump.
All I was trying to do in December is just quietly send off some birds to the hospital to get treatment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The chairman of the House Government Oversight Committee is renewing his attack on Alaska's bypass mail system that delivers everything from lettuce to lumber to rural Alaska. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaska's congressional delegation told him essentially to butt out.
Daryl Issa, who represents part of Southern California, has staged some high-profile fights in his committee, and he seemed to enjoy taking on his first two Alaska witnesses, Senator Mark Begich and Congressman Don Young. Issa is working on a bill he claims will reduce what the Postal Service loses on bypass mail, which last year hit $76 million.
The subsidy means that every 6 years, the American ratepayer is buying a bridge to nowhere.
Surely he knew those are fighting words to Young, who was champion of that Ketchikan project. But Young was plenty riled already. Young says bypass mail actually saves the Postal Service money, maybe $200 million, he claims, because shippers deliver goods in 1,000-pound lots directly to the airlines.
Bypass mail, people don't understand it. What it is, it's the products that we were going to ship parcel post don't go through the post office. That means you don't need to build more postal buildings. It means you don't have to hire any more people.
Young says the bypass mail system is working fine, and he accused ISA of meddling.
There's a $15 billion debt in the post office, and you're worried about $70 million that would have cost $200. I don't quite understand that. That's what you call picking up peanuts when you have a forest fire in your backyard. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
ISA also wants to allow three more carriers on the mainline routes for bypass mail out of Anchorage and Fairbanks. Competition on those routes is limited by a 2002 preference then-Senator Ted Stevens pushed through that gives most of the mail business to airlines that provide a certain level of passenger service. ISA says Stevens told him at the time he was trying to use bypass mail to subsidize passenger carriers. Young, in a testy exchange with ISA, insisted the limit makes economic sense.
Well, efficiency.
You can't efficiency be efficient if you don't haul passengers.
Well, okay, but it's all about passengers.
Well, it's about efficiency.
Well, you know, Don,
you're not have efficiency.
Begich told the chairman that carrier restrictions are also about safety. ISA wasn't buying it.
Are you saying that these other three carriers would not be safe to carry milk or vegetables or cans of Coke?
I'm saying the safety is part of the equation, but let me just say this.
What level of safety do you need for a can of Coke?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to go back and forth with you. Maybe you want to. I've seen how some of these hearings work.
Young, in a written statement to the committee, suggested ISA has been carrying water for a friend in the airline business. One airline that has fought to participate in the bypass mail program is Alaska Central Express. Ace Air Cargo is owned by the Donald R. Swartwood Trust. Mr. Swartwood is based in La Jolla, California, and is a frequent contributor to ISA's campaigns and his leadership PAC. A company executive testified today it would be cheaper if freight-only carriers were allowed to compete. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In Idaho, college students are protesting a bill that would allow guns on campus. Here in Alaska, they're drafting the legislation. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Hans Rodvik is a junior at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He's majoring in political science, and he's spending this semester as an intern for Senator John Coghill, a North Pole Republican. But before Rodvik came to Juneau, he and some classmates decided to try their own hand at drafting laws.
During the fall 2013 semester, a diverse array of students, including myself from the College Republicans, Young Americans for Liberty, and Political Science Association, came together to analyze what issues these three clubs could join together on and help change.
The issue they decided on was guns on campus, and Rodvik presented his bill to the Senate Judiciary Committee on Monday. The university's Board of Regents banned concealed carry in 1995. Guns are only allowed on campus in a very limited sense. They must be kept in special lockers or left in the parking lot in a locked car. Rodvik thinks that infringes on a student's constitutional right to bear arms.
We concluded that the current situation surrounding firearms on campus was unacceptable and committed to change it.
While the bill doesn't explicitly mention concealed carry, it blocks the Board of Regents from regulating guns and knives in all but two cases. It does allow them to stop people from shooting firearms in areas where humans, domestic animals, or property are at risk. The Regents can also prohibit firearms in restricted access areas under the bill. Even though the measure is a priority for some students, the president of the university system has some concerns. Pat Gamble opened his testimony to the Judiciary Committee by touting his own experience with guns.
Been carrying a gun by myself since I was 9 years old. Carried two guns in Vietnam every day, an AR-15 and a 38, which I used on several occasions. I shot expert in pistol and rifle and continued to shoot all through my time in the Air Force that way. Nevertheless, had a custom grip Beretta 38 that I carried as a general officer, shot it regularly, went through a number of training courses, both indoors and outdoors. So I'm pretty familiar with weapons.
Gamble also emphasized his support for the Second Amendment, but he said that the state is still able to regulate firearms for the good of the public. Gamble noted that guns are also prohibited at elementary schools and high schools with the goal of protecting young students. And that creates a tension with this bill, since those same children often visit University of Alaska campuses for classes and summer programs.
Do we protect them in the schools? Do we protect them when they're on the campus? I think the answer is yes.
Gamble told the Judiciary Committee that getting rid of the gun ban would force the university to ramp up security on its 16 campuses. He says it would be such a big and expensive project that he would want to consult with private security outfits with experience in the Middle East. And even then, Gamble thinks the university would need to stop inviting minors onto its campuses.
I will sit here and tell you right now, I cannot protect the campus. If the K through 12 kids are on there.
The bill will receive another hearing on Wednesday. Since the legislature first convened last year, 10 separate bills and resolutions concerning firearms have been introduced. Half of them have passed. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Iditarod race leaders left the checkpoint of Nikolai around midday today. Sonny Lindner, Hugh Neff, Ali Zirkel, and Nicholas Petit pulled out of Nikolai within an hour of each other. But five mushers, including Didi Jonro and Jake Berkowitz, scratched today because of broken equipment that was damaged on the extremely rough trail out of Rainy Pass. KUAC's Emily Schwing is in McGrath, where the first mushers are expected in this evening. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Lori.
Emily, what have you heard about the trail beyond Rainy Pass?
Well, it's a pretty rough trail out there. I did manage to speak with Sebastian Schnula. He is covering the race for the Iditarod Insider again this year. And he said it's like taking any bush trail and then running it in the summer. It's virtually snow-free for about 32 miles through an area known as the Farewell Burn. And it's funny, the Iditarod has gotten a couple nicknames out of this year's run on that stretch of trail. People are calling it the Iditarod or also the Iditabog.
Yikes. Sounds bad. Emily, most of the scratches were due to equipment failures, but many mushers still in the race have sustained injuries. Tell us about that.
Well, I actually have a long list, so I'll just read it to you, Lori. Martin Boozer has a sprained ankle. He got hung up on a stump and he was trying to decrease the swelling with a bag of snow. Aaron Burmeister has dislocated his knee, but he is determined to press on. Nicholas Petit also has an injured knee, but I hear it's not nearly as bad as Burmeister's.
What kind of trail will the mushers face beyond McGrath?
Well, I'm in McGrath on the ground, and there is significantly more snow here than there was flying over. And there's a little bit more snow here than I think there was in Rainy Pass yesterday. It's also a little colder. So I don't think they'll have the kinds of problems that they were facing today. But, you know, there's still a whole lot of trail ahead of us. And there were reports last week that it was raining up in White Mountain on the Bering Sea coast. So right now it's anybody's guess what mushers might face ahead of them.
All right, Emily, thank you so much for that update from the Iditarod Trail.
Sure thing, Lori. Thanks a lot.
KUAC's Emily Schwing reporting from McGrath. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaskan Paralympian prepares for an alpine event in Sochi.
There's going to be some air in there. You just have to have the confidence, the balance to land it and keep going.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Electronic health records free Alaskans from the paper chase by giving doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where they need it. Electronic health records increase safety and security. Electronic records take health information out of the filing cabinet and into the digital light. You can find out more at ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
It's common practice to burn trash in the Aleutians to keep landfills from overflowing, but it's not that simple in Adak, where flaming waste has killed or injured at least 10 bald eagles in the last few months. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it's now the subject of a federal investigation.
Bald eagles are born to hunt, but they're also excellent scavengers. If there's food around that's easy to get, eagles will go after it. And there's no easier target for an eagle than the dump. Keith Hamilton found that out firsthand when he started a job with ADAC's Public Works crew. Part of his job was to burn trash.
I noticed right away in November when I started working there that, you know, there was birds being burnt, and I found a few dead eagles out there, and I complained right away about it.
When bald eagles get hurt or killed, ADAC's municipal employees are supposed to contact the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service right away. That's because bald eagles are protected under federal law. The penalties are steep, possible jail time, and fines of up to $250,000. If it's an organization that's at fault, the fine could go all the way up to $500,000. Hamilton says he asked his supervisor in ADAC to report the eagles, but he also says those requests were brushed aside, and that didn't sit well with him.
You know, I mean, animals have souls, and if you would see those birds out there, you know, limping around the fire, eating garbage with no feathers, and they couldn't leave the fire pit, they were just trapped there. If anybody really looked at them, they would feel bad.
When Hamilton came across three eagles at the dump in December, scorched but alive, he didn't bother calling his boss or the authorities. He called an Anchorage bird sanctuary.
All I was trying to do in December is just quietly send off some birds to the hospital to get treatment.
But it didn't stay quiet. The rescue attracted the attention of the Anchorage Daily News, and one of their reporters reached out to ADAC city manager Leighton Lockett. Lockett says that that phone call was the first he'd heard about bald eagles getting burned or killed at his town's dump.
Up until these series of events, we had never had a problem, at least to my knowledge or to my other employees' knowledge as well.
Still, Lockett says ADAC took steps to fix it. They quit burning trash for most of the winter and buried it instead. And the city started to build a $25,000 enclosure for the burn pit. But it wasn't quite done before Public Works employees decided to burn trash there again at the end of February. Hamilton was there at the time, and he says he saw eagles all around the edge of the fire.
I had a bad feeling. They made me leave the dump. I came back, you know, the next day, looked around, and then, you know, I started spotting more eagles that were injured.
At one point, Hamilton was stopped by an ADAC police officer who allegedly told Hamilton he'd be breaking federal law if he picked up a bald eagle, even if he was just trying to help it. That's not true, according to Ryan Knoll. He's a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
In fact, the Fish and Wildlife Service would encourage a person to find an eagle that's distressed to take careful measures to try and save it.
But they can't be sure that everything in ADAC has happened by the book. Noel says that's why the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sent an agent and a biologist to the island this week.
You know, we looked to see if there was any intent to do any harm and to determine if there was, in fact, then obviously we refer that information onto the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they would determine if there was any grounds for prosecution.
While they're in ADAC, the Fish and Wildlife team will be a resource to city officials who are looking for safe options to keep eagles out of the dump. With the right federal permits, ADAC could use lights and sirens to try to spook the birds away. For now, the city's focused on the renovated burn pit at their dump. They're going to ask the federal investigators to check it and make sure it's up to their standards. And until then, ADAC isn't burning any more of its trash. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
State officials want the federal government to remove some protections for southeast and south central humpback whales. But a noted researcher says it's too early to do that. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Whalers killed so many humpbacks in the 19th and 20th centuries that many worried they might become extinct. Harvests ended in the mid-1960s when an international treaty took effect. Then populations began to grow as governments adopted protective policies.
This is a success story. This is one species that no longer needs the protection of the Endangered Species Act, and we should celebrate that.
Doug Vincent Lang is director of the state's Division of Wildlife Conservation. He says humpbacks will stay safe even if they lose the act's protections.
Even if you delisted the species at the end of the day, they'd still be adequately protected under existing whaling agreements and existing Marine Mammal Protection Act regulations.
He says humpbacks are numerous in waters from Cook Inlet to southern southeast, the population the state wants delisted. The whales still die of disease and old age when hit by ships or tangled in fishing gear. But he says rapid population growth, which the state estimates at 7%, means there are plenty to replace them. University of Alaska marine biologist Jan Straley says it's not that easy.
Just to say you're going to delist the central stock is almost a simplistic way of saying these whales are one big group, but really, in essence, when they come to Alaska, they aren't.
Straley says breaking up Alaska humpbacks into eastern or western populations does not reflect their full life cycle. Most southeast whales winter in Hawaiian waters, though some swim to Mexico. But when they return in the summer, they split up and head to specific parts of the coast. As that cycle repeats, they develop hereditary differences.
You could basically wipe out a whole genetic lineage of whales if something happened catastrophically. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but, you know, it's a risk of kind of ignoring that part of the structure of the population.
She agrees humpback numbers have grown, but she says the most frequently used estimate is based on old research, so there's no way of knowing for sure what's happening now. The petition to remove the whales from Endangered Species Act listings was submitted to the National Marine Fisheries Service, also called NOAA Fisheries. That agency has 90 days to decide whether it's worth considering the petition. If it does, spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says a full review will take about a year.
We look at factors that may cause the population to have difficulty in the future, like ocean acidification, lack of food, that type thing.
If the petition is approved, the population will continue to be covered by the Federal Marine Mammals Protection Act. That prohibits hunting, requires habitat protections, and sets a safe distance for whale watching tours. So what more does the Species Act do? NOAA Fisheries' John Kerlin says it reviews any federally funded work that could affect the whales.
We do consultations on things as simple as coastal construction projects, revamping a port or harbor, driving piles for a wharf, to broader scale activities like seismic exploration for oil and gas.
NOAA Fisheries pulled eastern North Pacific gray whales off the list 20 years ago, and last year it delisted eastern Steller sea lions, which live in southeast. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
As Alaskans weigh how to vote on a ballot initiative that would fully legalize marijuana, the University of Alaska Anchorage is holding a forum on Wednesday evening debating the issue. Tonight, we bring you the perspective of one of those panelists. Lance Buchholz is a retired Midwestern sheriff who joined Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, in 2013. He says the war on drugs isn't working.
And for what we're paying to keep someone in prison, I think we'd be far better off to get them a tech school or college level education rather than just house them. And I'm talking about the nonviolent offenders, of course. Get them some help.
In your experience as sheriff, what substance caused the most mayhem when you were out?
Alcohol.
There were crimes.
Alcohol is by far the biggest problem that you would have. There's a demon in that bottle for some people. They just have to stay away from any form of alcohol. They just cannot control their behavior when they drink. That's where a lot of the domestic abuse situations come in, that kind of thing. Can't really say I saw a lot of that with people that smoked marijuana. There just wasn't a huge law enforcement issue, other than the marijuana itself being illegal. Their behavior problems, no. And what Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is saying is it should just be taxed and regulated. Just tax and regulate. That's our whole position.
When you think about the idea of how the law should look and the idea of simplifying it, tax and regulate, how should that look? What should it be reflective of? The way alcohol is regulated, or are there other ideas for a different policy approach to how marijuana should be
regulated? Yeah, something like that. I believe that Colorado has a marijuana regulation board, if I'm not mistaken. Other states can be very clever when it comes to how they're going to tax and get the revenue from sale of this product, just like you would alcohol or tobacco. And we'd have savings on the other end where we wouldn't have to be incarcerating these nonviolent offenders anymore.
One of the big concerns that opponents of legalization of marijuana cite is the concern over access for young people. There's new studies showing that kids who start smoking marijuana early have lower IQ rates later on. Do you worry about an expansion of access or legalization of a Schedule I drug, as marijuana is considered now, making it more appealing or more broadly available to young people? What's your concern as a former sheriff about the young person element in this?
Well, there's a couple things to consider. And of course, we don't want to expand, you know, usage to young children, obviously. But you have to ask yourself right now, okay, it's illegal and you have police running around doing what we can. Are we really stopping kids from accessing it now? Is that really be realistic? We're not stopping it now. So if you tax and regulate it like you would tobacco or alcohol, at least you would have the government controlling the marketplace.
Retired Sheriff Lance Buchholz will be part of a panel discussion on marijuana laws at UAA on Wednesday evening. Tomorrow, we'll hear the opposing view from former Alaska Assistant Attorney General Dean Guinelli. Juno's Joe Tompkins will represent the United States in the Paralympic Winter Games in Sochi, Russia. Tompkins and Andrew Kirka of Palmer are among 26 athletes named to the U.S. Paralympic Alpine Ski Team. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, Tompkins has had a successful World Cup career but has never medaled in the Paralympics.
Sochi will be Joe Tompkins' fourth Paralympic Winter Games.
Four and done.
Tompkins admits he's said that every 4 years since the Salt Lake City Paralympics in 2002. When he gets to Sochi, he will be skiing a single downhill race. To get ready, he's been bombing the trails at Eagle Crest Ski Area.
I'm going for it.
Tompkins is paralyzed from the waist down. He sits in what he calls a bucket atop a single ski. His gear looks like it's held together with duct tape. Now age 45, he decided it was time to retire from racing. Then he got a call from the Paralympic alpine coach who said Tompkins should join the team in Sochi. First, he needed to get back on his monoski and prove he could still compete, so he went to Aspen for the U.S. National Championships in early February. He came in sixth.
After 3 days of skiing. for the season.
The Paralympic downhill course at Sochi is similar to the Olympic downhill, with some of the same jumps.
There's going to be some air in there. You just have to have the confidence, the balance to land it and keep going.
Tompkins says mono skiers can get a lot of air.
If you watch the able body coming up to a jump, they suck up their knees, so it's less. But we're going with a solid shock. You have to be pretty quiet in the air to land it because you're on one ski. The two things, the outriggers that people see in your arms, those are just for balance. Those aren't for skiing at all.
Tompkins says he wasn't convinced he should go to the Paralympics. Sochi is a big commitment. Baseball training is getting underway, and he's assistant baseball coach at Thunder Mountain High School.
And I told my mom that I really didn't think that I should go over there, and she goes, what would you tell your boys? That pretty much stuck in my head. Of course, I would tell them to go for it. Swing the bat. Swing it like you mean it.
Tompkins was paralyzed in a 1988 alcohol-related car accident near Auk Bay. He wasn't driving, but he and three other young men in the car were drunk. One died. A few years later, it hit him. That's when he decided he needed to help kids stay away from alcohol and drugs. His message is blunt.
If you're getting drugs and alcohol, it's going to be harder to get out of that and come back to where your dreams and your goals are. And I'm a constant reminder because they ask me what happened to me. And I tell them. I don't lie to them. I don't sugarcoat it. It's about motivation. It's about never giving up.
To compete in the Paralympics, Tompkins says he's been training to build confidence and balance as well as speed.
I'm just thinking that I got to ski smart, ski fast, and let it go. I would hope that the fourth is my lucky charm.
In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in McGrath, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.